There's so many things I'd love you to know that God has been so good. I had planned to speak of his great faithfulness. And one of the outstanding things to me in his faithfulness was the way he gave us the hospital. I remember back many years ago now when I was going inland for the first time on a funny little riverboat. I never dreamt to have such an experience. We were 23 on a little boat that had four cabins. It had no washrooms, had no toilet. You just went out over the back, over the flywheel that spun the boat up country, and I was scared to death of falling over the back end there. But you can't go 14 days without going. But I always remember one outstanding thing. I asked the Lord to give me a special blessing from his word, to encourage my heart that I was in his will. And that afternoon he gave me the verse, "Not aught hath failed of all the good things which he hath spoken unto thee. Behold, all have come to pass." And I took it as his promise that I could trust him all the way through, that all would come to pass. And I can tell you, after all these years, that's my testimony. He was altogether faithful, and not aught hath failed of all the good promises that he gave me. But I tell you of the hospital, because it's a project that was very dear to my heart, and perhaps one that caused me to marvel at his greatness more than anything else. It was in 1946. My husband had come home from an executive meeting, worn out, because he'd had to sit out all night. Just as he was crossing a high wooden bridge over a big river, just as he was about to come off at the hind wheels of the old Ford, sank through the planks. He didn't know what to do. He couldn't begin to unload the car then. It was just about ready for the sun to drop. There's no twilight in Africa. The sun drops and it's the blackness of night. So he hurriedly got off a lantern from the side of the car and a bit of food out of his chop box and crossed. He had to leave natives at the runway, the planks that lead up onto the buck, to guard with the lantern so folks would see and nobody come and try to run onto the buck in the night. And it was nothing to for them to do but sit down by the side of the road and wait for the morning. He said he was literally chewed up with mosquitoes and tsetse flies that night. When it came daylight, he was able to work and get the car out and get off the bridge and go by the government post to tell them about the bridge being out of commission and so forth. But didn't get home until afternoon. Completely worn out. But of course he thought, and I thought, he'd be all right after he'd had a good rest. But instead it was only a matter of a couple weeks. He started running a high fever, feeling so miserable all the time. Nothing that I tried seemed to help. So I asked one of the neighbors to take us to the hospital, the French hospital, the bombers 75 miles away. The doctor said it was tropical fatigue. We'd stayed in the colony too long. Said, "I don't know what's the matter with you folks. You shouldn't stay long terms like you do. We stayed 5 and 6 years. They go home every 18 months or 2 years at the most." He said, "If you'd go home and rest, you'd be all right." There was no one to replace us. We were alone on the station. This was the beginning of the dry season when you changed the grass on the roof. We had three buildings that needed the grass changed. Mr. Laird said he couldn't go home. He would go down and work for a few hours, come home and stretch out on the rattan mat on the floor and sleep. It was too hot to go to bed. Then he would go back down to work. Kept up another month. I took him back to the hospital. No satisfaction. Finally, the third time I took him back, because things were developing that I began to suspicion Mr. Laird had sleeping sickness. I said, "Doctor, would you please examine him for sleeping sickness?" He walked over and felt the glands on the back of his neck while he was past the stage where they were swollen. And he says, "Oh, you nurses, you know, just enough to make yourself and everybody else miserable. What makes you think your husband's got sleeping sickness?" I couldn't begin to go into the details in front of Mr. Laird. So we went home. Mr. Laird said, "Don't ever ask me again to go back to that doctor." He finished changing the roofs on the building, but he was getting no better. I insisted that we leave on furlough. So we turned the work over to Mananga, our African pastor, and we got ready and left for furlough. When we finally got to Leopoldville, where we were to have our first plane trip on the Pan American, we took him to the doctor, Dr. Stobe, a very fine French doctor that had gotten disgusted with the French government's way of handling their work, and he had gone to Belgium, Congo, to open an office, a private office at Leopoldville. As soon as we come in the office, he says, "What have you waited so long for?" I says, "What do you mean? I've had him to the hospital three times and they tell me nothing's the matter with him." And he says, "Madam Laird, your husband's in advanced stages of sleeping sickness." I said, "How can you tell that just to look at him?" He said, "Oh, we won't treat him from that diagnosis. But he says from the little nerve in the corner of his mouth." We spent the day at the laboratory. Spinal puncture, blood tests, all manner of tests. They entered him that night in Queen Astrid Hospital. The next day, they began the treatment. They said, "You can go to America. There's two hospitals where you can have treatment. Walter Reed Hospital in Washington or here are the only two that understand tropical trypanosomiasis." Guy chose to stay there. The French give all their medication according to weight. Used to embarrass me in the early years. We had to go ever so often for different inoculations, yellow fever and one thing and another. When the doctor would look up and see me in the line, he turned to the nurse, "Double the dose." Well, I got used to it. Got over being embarrassed. Mr. Laird was a man my size. They doubled the dose. Evidently too much. It's an intravenous injection. Mr. Laird went into a coma. Never came out. That night he went to be with the Lord. I had to wait a week for the plane to come on home alone. And all the way I kept thinking, if we'd had a conscientious Christian doctor that would have made a thorough examination when I first took him, Mr. Laird might have been spared for the work. I know God doeth all things well. It was in his hands. I wasn't complaining against the Lord, but I'd admit there was a bitterness in my heart toward those doctors. And then it seemed to me the Lord said, "What are you doing about them having Christian doctors and proper treatment?" I wasn't doing a thing. I was doing all I possibly could as a nurse at the dispensary. But it never seemed to occur to my mind that we could have a hospital and doctors and proper equipment to do with. And I began thinking and planning. And you know, it was marvelous the way it developed in my mind. I could hardly wait to be home to go to the mission office and tell them about it. But when I landed in New York, I went down to South Carolina first. My children were in school there by that time. Both my girls were in their first year at Columbia Bible College, and my son in the Westerfeld home. I got them. I had to wait almost 2 weeks till that school term closed. There was a young man that had an aunt in Denver he wanted very much to visit but couldn't afford to. But he'd bought an old second-hand Ford from a missionary that was going back to the field, and he said, if I pay all the expenses, he'd drive us through to Denver. So we were coming with him, and that way I would get to go by Cleveland, too. So all enthused, I went down to tell the mission office of my dream of having a hospital. They listened very patiently. But then Mr. Fetzer said, we understand, we appreciate your views. But I said, we don't believe you begin to realize what it would cost to build a modern hospital in the heart of Africa. And what good would a hospital do without doctors? And you're not apt to have doctors apply to a faith mission. We have no guaranteed salary. We have nothing for working funds. You just go with what the Lord provides. And if you have a burden for doing any work, you look to the Lord to supply the need of that work. And he says, doctors give 12 of the best years of their lives in study. They're not going to apply to a faith mission. Well, I went home utterly discouraged that night. And then I got to thinking there were other faith missions had doctors. And I thought, who do you think you are? There's never any question in your mind going out by faith. Think of the way God's provided for you. Who do you think you are that God couldn't lead a doctor just the same? Then I asked the Lord to give me something from his word, that I would know it was of him. And I took up the word and something said, read 2 Kings, the 7th chapter. Well, I opened and read it. It's too long for us to read now, but you read it over several times when you go home, the 6th and the 7th chapter. And I thought, what in the world's that got to do with me? That couldn't possibly have been from the Lord. But something said, read it again. So I went back and read it again. I couldn't see a thing in it for me. It's at the time when Israel was besieged by the Syrian army. And they'd been cut off. They were completely surrounded by the Syrians. There was famine in the land. They were dying of starvation. It had come to the place where a woman ate her own son. And just at that time, God sends his prophet Elisha to tell them, this time tomorrow, a measure of fine wheat would be sold in the city gate for a shekel, and 2 measures of barley for a shekel. And the man on whose arm the king leaned mocked. He said, if God made windows in heaven, could such a thing come to pass? And Elisha said, you will see it with your eyes, but you will not taste thereof. How in the world did God bring to pass such an impossible thing? The chapter goes on to tell us there were 4 leprous men without the city gate. They were starving like everybody else. But that night they said, what are we sitting here for, starving to death? Let's go give ourselves up to the enemy. Perhaps they'll feed us. And if they don't, what's the difference whether we die at the hand of the enemy or die from starvation? So the 4 lepers went over to the camp of the Syrians to give themselves up. And to their astonishment, they found no Syrians. the camp was forsaken. They went into one tent and spoiled it, ate all they could, gathered together fine apparel and silver and gold, went to the next tent. But then one of them says, "We do not well. Today is a day of glad tidings. If we hold our peace till the morning light, surely some mischief will come upon us." And so they decide to leave everything and go back to the camp of the Israelites and tell them. They couldn't go in and ask for a hearing before the king. They were lepers. They had to stay without the city gate. But they gave their message to the gatekeeper. He relayed it to the king. And the king said, "This is their strategy. They know we're starving. They figure we'll come out for something to eat. Then they'll surround us and completely cut us off." But some of his counselors said, "There are a few horses left. Why don't we send men on horses to see?" And they did. And all along the path as they went, they found the path strewn with pots and pans and things that the Syrians discarded as they fled in their haste. And why did they flee? God had caused them to hear a noise in their ears. So they said the Israelites had gotten the Egyptians and the Amorites and the Hittites and the otherites to come up and join them. And so they fled. The Israelites went in and spoiled the camp. And it came to pass, as the prophet Elisha said, a measure of fine flour and two measures of barley were sold in the city gate for a shekel. What happened to the one that mocked and said, "If God made windows in heaven, could such a thing come to pass?" The king appointed him the keeper of the gate. You can imagine that whole crowd starving. There was food being sold at a price they could afford. There was a regular stampede. That man was trodden underfoot till he died. He saw it with his eye, but he never tasted thereof. And as I thought of that, I thought, it isn't a little thing to distrust God. You know, we turn it aside so lightly. We say, "Of course God's able. He's abundantly able, but I don't have faith." That doesn't excuse us. God's given us his word. That should be enough for any of us. You begin making excuses for yourself. Stop and think. What instruments did he use there? Four lepers. Despised, unclean, without the city gate. Dare any of us say God couldn't use us? But sometimes I think those lepers were more honorable than we are. They said, "We do not well. Today is a day of glad tidings, and we hold our peace. If we tarry till the morning light, surely some mischief will come upon us. The night is far spent. The day is at hand. We're looking for Christ's return any day. But what are we doing to get the good news out? If we're doing nothing, surely some mischief will come upon us." As I read that chapter over again and thought upon it, I thought, God wouldn't have given me a vision of building a hospital in the heart of Africa if he didn't intend to make it possible. So I went right back down to the mission office first thing in the morning. I said, will you authorize me to speak of the need of a hospital in the churches where God gives me opportunity to speak? Why, surely. I said, will you open a hospital account? I said, God's going to give me money. And I don't want the responsibility of handling it myself and my personal account. Will you open a hospital account? Surely, money comes in. That's all I wanted to know. I went home, we packed, went on our way. We decided we'd rather spend the weekend in Mishawaka, Indiana, where two of our missionary families that were very dear friends were on furlough. We got there and got settled Friday evening, sat up late visiting. So we were having a late breakfast Saturday morning. The doorbell rang. Esther went to the door. She come back, she says, it's the nearest mail special delivery for you, Margaret. I says, who in the world knows I'm here? She said, it looks like Texas is writing. Sure enough, a letter from Tex and Alice Warnken, missionary couples that had worked on our station one term, then taken over one of our outstations. They had been out on the West Coast when they got word of guys going. They decided to change their routing and come by Denver to see me. When they got to my home, my mother told them I wasn't there. Have you any idea where we could reach her? Yes, she's spending the weekend at Money Smith's. Well, of course, these folks knew just where that was. They said, can we come in and write a letter? So they wrote me this letter. They said, we're on our way now going east to go back to Africa. We want so much to see you before we go. Wouldn't it be possible to change your plans and come to Kansas City? Texas speaking morning and evening. Told to swear. We talked it over and repacked and left for Kansas City. Sunday morning we came into the church just as Guy, as Tex went to the pulpit. Afterwards the pastor said, you folks are invited to join us all at a chicken dinner out in the country. We've been invited to neighbors of President Truman's for chicken dinner. And I said, oh, but pastor, there's five in my party. And he said, that's all right. That never be flustered a Kansas housewife. There'll be plenty of chicken. He said, they're just making big tables out under the trees. So we went. Had a wonderful meal. I sat next to the pastor. Tex was just across the table from me. I hardly got to taste any of that chicken. They just asked one question after another. They wanted to know all about Guy's sickness because he'd been very well when they had last seen him. Then, of course, the big question, you won't be going back to Africa, will you? You won't go back alone. And I says, why, of course I'll go back alone. God called me when I was alone. I said, surely. Well, you can't go back to Ippi. I said, why not? I don't intend to go anyplace else. And he said, oh, it'd be too hard to go back there where you lived together and where you left everything just as he left it. They said, we'd like to invite you to our station. Won't you let us stop by the mission office and arrange to have you appointed to Bria? I said, no. We talked. The pastor was taking in everything. Afterwards, he says, Mrs. Laird, would you be willing to speak to our young people tonight? I said, surely. He said, we'll move the service up to 6 o'clock, so you have plenty of time. Well, they did, and they had a big young people's. But they came up asking so many questions afterwards. The next thing I knew, the organ had started in the sanctuary. And I said, oh, we're going to be late. This was a large church, and they had a good crowd. By the time I got in the sanctuary, the only place I could find was the next to the last row back under the balcony. But I sat there, and the service completed. The pastor gave the invitation, was ready for the benediction. said, no, I have no liberty to close this meeting. Says, there's a woman in our audience tonight I heard talking this noon. And he said, I'd never heard such things before. I'd like to ask permission of the deacons for this woman to stand right where she is and in 5 minutes tell us what's on her heart. I thought, does he mean me? How could I tell him what's on my heart in 5 minutes? Then he says, Mrs. Laird, we're waiting on you. Well, I stood up and talked exactly 5 minutes and sat down. Afterwards, when we were going out, they had found different homes. We had to separate, but they'd found homes that had room to keep us, and we were staying overnight. He said, the ladies would like you to not be in a hurry in the morning. They'd like to put up chicken dinner and lunch enough to see you through to Denver. And I says, that'd be very lovely. We'll not hurry. They put me in a home right across the street from the church. 7:45, he came over and asked if we were through with breakfast, could I come over to the church? He'd like to visit with me in his office for a minute. I went over, here's the board of trustees and all the deacons. They've met at 7:00 in his office. The spokesman spoke up, and he said, Mrs. Laird, we everyone felt God sent you our way last night. He touched our hearts. We have some of the Lord's money. We'd like to give you the first $5,000 to the hospital. I learned afterwards this was a church that didn't believe in a woman speaking in the church. Never before had they asked a woman to speak. That's why he had to ask the deacon's permission for me to rise back where I was under the balcony and speak. And yet they gave the first $5,000 to the hospital. And I thought, doesn't the Lord use unlikely ways? He wants us to know it's all of him. Nobody there that had ever seen me before. But God touched their hearts and they came. Time wouldn't permit me to tell you all the marvelous way that God provided through that furlough. The doors he opened for me. When I thought I had everything ready to go back, I went from a final examination. They said, you'll have to have your gallbladder out before you go. Nothing to do. I went into the hospital, had my gallbladder out. But the liver was grown to the gallbladder. They said they couldn't possibly take out the gallbladder without injuring the liver and I wouldn't live. So they decided to just sew me up. But the doctor that had sent me in said to the chief surgeon, if you do that, you close this woman's way of going to Africa. She's a woman of God. She has faith. She believes God's called her. If we do our part, then it's God's responsibility. But if you close her up, it's your responsibility. So the surgeon went ahead and completed surgery. For 6 weeks, I lay draining quarts and quarts and quarts of bile every day. Yellower than a pumpkin. My eyes so yellow I couldn't see straight. They sent for all my children and said I couldn't possibly live. I was in a semi-coma, but I heard. And I said, Lord, don't let me linger long. Arlene was in training then, taking her psychiatric training at Pueblo, and they brought her home. I knew what it would mean to miss out on that. She'd have to wait for another term to go back. And I said, take me quickly. But the Lord reminded me of that hospital in Africa. And the assurance of what he had begun, he would finish. I knew I would get well. After 6 weeks, I couldn't keep a thing on my stomach. One day I had the bright idea. I said, could I have a drink of root beer? Nurse says, yes, it'll come right back up like everything else. But she got me a glass of root beer, and it stayed down. And I began drinking and keeping it down. Within 6 weeks of that, I appeared at the mission office, still all yellow, the whites of my eyes bronze. Mr. Fetzer said, you can't go back to Africa like this. It'd be absolutely ridiculous. I said, I've got to go now. He said, what do you mean? I said, I'm going to Matabe at the mouth of the Congo River. I want to go up the river. I've got so much baggage, it'll be much cheaper by river than overland transport by truck. And he said, but you're in no condition for it. I said, I'm going on a little Belgian freighter, maybe the only passenger. There's only room for six. I said, who'd ever have a better time for rest? I won't have a thing in the world to do but read and sleep. Then I'll have all that time up the river to rest. And I said, once I get the baggage in, if I'm not able to go to work, I'll rest some more. Well, he said, Mrs. Laird, I'll have to tell you. The men of the field have all told me not to permit you to come with this baggage. There hasn't been any hospital voted for Africa. And it'll never be voted for EP if it is. And I says, why shouldn't I go that way? They tell me it's impossible, he said. I said, Mr. Fetzer, I believe definitely I'm called of God. If you're going to hinder me doing what I believe is his will, I have a right to know who those men are and what's their objection. And so he got out the letters and showed me. Not a one of them had ever gone inland that way. I said, Mr. Fetzer, I went that way as a single girl with a party of five, and I took care of all the baggage and all the douan, the custom paper. I said, I came out that way with my husband. We went back that way. And my husband let me make out all the official papers because I had French better. I said, I know it can be done, and so much cheaper. And he said, I believe you. I'm going to let you go. But he says, this one thing, you must keep a very accurate account of everything. Because you see, these men say, you'll be held up at Matadi 3 weeks, you'll be held up at Leopoldville 3 weeks, you'll have at least 2 weeks at Brazzaville. And all those hotel bills are going to run much higher than truck transport. I said, I'll keep a very accurate account. I did. I put down every cup of tea and cup of coffee that I had on the train trip inland and up the river and all. I had plenty of time on that boat to pray. And oh, how I prayed that the Lord would overrule, that I'd get through. I had 28 tons of baggage with me. We landed at Matadi at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The Swedish missionary met the boat. There were two American businessmen going out for a plywood factory. Neither one of them knew a bit of French or any native language. They'd never been in Africa before. The Swedish missionary said, if you know French, you take care of your baggage and I'll take care of these men. So I passed everything I had in the cabin with me. When he finished, we went out to the mission. Next morning, I asked, was there a car available? I'd like to go back to the boat company. He said, did you leave something in your cabin? I said, no, I've got all that with me. I want to see about the baggage that was in the hold. He said, oh, lady, you don't understand. It'll be 2 or 3 weeks before that boat's unloaded. He says, you won't need to go down for a long time. Well, I waited till he'd gone. He was going to the bank with these two Americans after they were gone, well out of the way. I started out walking. Hadn't gone very far, and I found a taxi. And I went on to the boat company. I told the man what I'd come for. It was very courteous and nice. Then he suddenly says, what boat was that? And I said, Bessot. He turned to look at me. He said, well, the Bessot just docked at 3 o'clock yesterday afternoon. I said, yes, I know. I was a passenger on it. Lady, what was the matter with you? You didn't take your baggage off with you. I said, oh, I took everything I had in the cabin. This is the baggage in the hold. He says, baggage in the hold? There isn't such a thing. It's freight if it's in the hold. I pointed to the paper. It said, Madam Laird, accompanied by 28 tons of baggage. And I'd taken the paper to the French consul and had it visaed. Well, he didn't know what to do. So he just started raving what he thought about these Americans that thought they could move heaven and earth. The most impatient things. And what was a woman doing traveling alone anyhow? Didn't I have any youngsters to take care of? Why didn't I stay home and take care of them? I didn't know what to do. Just then a man stepped up. I'd seen him on the boat some, but never had any occasion to know who he was or what. He happened to be a first mate of the boat. And he said, excuse me, what was the name on that package? The man says, Laird, L-A-I-R-D. And he bared his teeth just like a dog. I started stepping back. The man said, well, that's interesting. He said, I saw that name all over the wharf last night. I stepped nearer and pricked up my ears. He said, let me tell you a story. He said, last time we came out, we brought the president of the Otraco, a new Buick from America. It's a beautiful big green Buick. He was so proud of it. But he said, you didn't bring me an extra set of tires. I said, no, you didn't say anything about tires. Those are good tires. They'll do you for years. He says, I want a whole set of spares. All right, next time. He said, the next day I met him in town. He reminded me of those tires. He said he came to the boat before we took off and reminded me about those tires. He said when we were halfway across the Atlantic, I got a radiogram reminding me of those tires. And he said the first time we got off the boat in Brooklyn, a cablegram. See that my tires are the first thing on the boat. And he said I was fed up with those tires. I said, all right, we will. So he said his four new tires went right down in the bottom of hold one. And 28 tons of Madam Laird's baggage went in on top of them. He said, when we docked yesterday, he appeared for his tires. And I said, well, you told me to see they were the first thing on the boat. Doesn't that make them down at the bottom of the hold? And he said, all right, smart aleck, you turn on the floodlights and unload, but I want those tires at 6 o'clock in the morning. So they started unloading my baggage on the wharf. Pretty soon the police appeared. There was a city ordinance, absolutely nothing on the wharf after dark. He said, if you're going to unload, you're going to unload it directly to the warehouse. So they sent for the man with the key to the warehouse. He'd gone to a party on an island out in the Congo. His wife said she didn't know when he might be back. Maybe 3 o'clock in the morning, maybe not till daylight. She said he likely has the key in his pocket. I won't waste time looking for it. But the man wasn't to be put off. He said, all right, you roll two boxcars down on the wharf and load that baggage in. So all my baggage was loaded in the boxcars, ready to leave Matadi at 10 o'clock the morning after we docked. When I went back to the Swedish mission and I asked them, would it be possible to have a cup of coffee at 6 o'clock in the morning? I was leaving on the 7 o'clock train. Oh, no, you're not. I said, why not? And he said, we have too much work to take care of other missions' baggage. You'll have to stay till you've taken care of your baggage yourself. I said, oh, my baggage is all on the boxcar, ready to leave for Leopoldville. That's absolutely impossible. It was almost dinner time, but nothing would do. I get in that car and go back down to the boat company with him. He had to see with his own eyes. He took me right by the railroad station and bought my ticket on the train for 7 o'clock in the morning. When we got to Leopoldville, I made out all my papers, went through all the formalities for customs. $1,015 customs they wanted. But I said, all of that's just in transit. I can't pay you that money. I'll have nothing to pay the boat company on the French side to take it. He says, what do you expect me to do? And I says, why, you have boats that go across the pool yourself. I said, why don't you send it and then you'll know I don't touch it. I said, you can consign it direct to the French boat company. I'll not touch it. That's entirely irregular. I just stood there. Pretty soon he sat down and started to write and handed me the papers. I didn't pay a cent in Leopoldville. The very next day, I was on my way. And that's the way the Lord took care of it. When I got to Bangui, the boat with the baggage didn't arrive till sometime afterwards. But it arrived a Thursday evening. I knew there was no need to go down Friday. The missionary would just get mad at me for asking him. But Saturday morning, I suggested I'd like to go downtown with him and see if they'd unloaded my baggage. He says, Margaret, you know better than that. Things don't move that way in Africa. He said, you're lucky if that's off the boat in 2 weeks. I said, would it hurt to go by and look in the warehouse? Ugh. But he took me. There it was, all in the warehouse. I said, I've got all my papers made out for French customs. So we went into the douanier. But he had said to me, I'll help you with everything but the cement. You'll have to hire a transitor. I wouldn't undertake that. While the douanier was doing some of the figuring out, Mr. Brown had to go out to the car for something. I hurriedly said to him, what's so difficult about the cement that I can't make out the papers for that? He said, it's the most simple thing in the world. That's building material. But he said, what are you declaring it for? I gave him the papers, the receipted bill that had also passed the French consul. He says, good girl, you've declared it $15 more than we value it. He made out the papers. At 11:45, I was all through with the douane, but to pass to the treasurer and pay. I came in to him. It was $1,012 there. Naturally, I didn't have the money with me. He said, oh, you don't pay here. You pass chez le trésor. That's way up the hill. And I said, but I can't possibly get there before noon and all the bureaus close at noon. Can't you accept my check? He said, how do I know you've got money in the bank? You've just arrived. I said, Mr. Braun is our treasurer. I said, you've known him for years. Yes. And I says, well, if he'll tell you he deposited $1,500 for me in the bank yesterday, will you believe him if he shows you the credit slip? Mr. Braun laid down the deposit slip. Man sat down and wrote for a few minutes. 5 minutes to 12, I went out of the Douanier office with everything paid. Just time to get to the transport office before noon. Make arrangements. I was going on a 20-ton remorque. That's, what is it in this country? Semi-trailer that they put 20 tons on, and I was going to ride with the native chauffeur. There was a Greek hardware man in there that was listening while we were talking. He followed me out. I'd known him for several terms. And he says, "Mrs. Laird, I'd like you to go home for dinner. My wife's with me this term. I'd like you to meet my wife." I said, "Oh, but I can't. They're expecting me at the mission." And he said, "Could we come and call on you this afternoon?" I said, "Surely." So they came. And he said, "My wife and I have to make a trip to Ypi. We wondered if you couldn't go with us." Nothing would suit me better. He also had a beautiful big Buick. And he says, "There's just one thing. We'd like to go tomorrow afternoon and stay overnight at the mission at Cebu." Nothing would please me better. First station where I'd ever been, where I had precious friends. I knew if I went with the native chauffeur, he would never turn up that steep, steep hill for me to stay overnight. I said, "That'd be wonderful." He said, "My wife will put up lunch enough to see us through. Don't you bother with anything." Such a lunch. Caviar and all manner of stuff. We left the next afternoon. We arrived at Ypi one evening. The next morning when they got up, were ready to go, I wanted to pay him. And he says, "Why, Madam Laird, do you think I'd take any money from you?" He'd had a friend follow with 5 tons of the baggage, and the rest was to come later on the remorque. He said, "I had no business at Ypi." But he said, "I heard you making arrangements to go." And I thought, would anyone do that to my mother? Would they let my mother ride on a semi-trailer truck? I went home and told my wife, and she said, "Let's us take her." He said, "It's our privilege." I paid nothing to get through to Ypi. But then there was a problem with my own co-workers. They didn't want the hospital at Ypi. Why, Ypi was way in the backwoods. We had main stations where a hospital should be. They all seemed to think it should be at Fort Crampel because that's where we had our missionaries' children's school. Well, my burden wasn't specially for them. All of our missionaries had cars then. It was less than 200 miles to come to Ypi. If one of their youngsters got sick, they wouldn't hesitate a minute. They'd find the gasoline and come to Ypi. The thousands of Africans in our district, who'd take them in a car if they needed to go to the hospital? Well, it came conference time. We have 3 days of Bible study and prayer before we go into business sessions. Then they started. The first item to come up was about the hospital. Oh, all the arguments. Finally, Mr. Rosenow, the field director, said, "It seems to be the consensus of opinion the hospital ought to be here at Crampville, where the children's school is. Mr. Hammond, you're the director of Fort Crampel Station. Are you willing to undertake the burden of the hospital? Are you willing to undertake the program of building? You understand it's at your expense. You look to the Lord for the funds." "I am not. I've got all I can manage right now. I couldn't possibly take on a building program." "How are you going to have a hospital if somebody won't build it?" And he went around to every man of a station that had been suggested. No one of them were willing to undertake it. Then he opened the scripture and read about Israel had cried unto the Lord when they were bond slaves in Egypt. And God raised up a man. And on he went, and always it was God raised up a man. And I thought, huh, they're going to hold that against me because I'm a woman. But when he got through, he said, every one of us recognize the need of a hospital. But he said, we haven't found any man that's willing to undertake it. But we found from Scripture, when God intends to do something, he prepares the person he's going to use. He said, in this case, he's raised up a woman. Mrs. Laird is willing to undertake the full financial responsibility of the hospital. She's willing to oversee the making of the bricks and the putting up of the building. She's come with 28 tons of equipment for it. He said, are we ready to take the vote where the hospital will be situated? There was a unanimous vote that the hospital be at Ippi and Mrs. Laird be responsible. God works. And I couldn't tell you how marvelously he undertook. I was alone then. But I got the bricks made even while I was taking care of the hospital, but the dispensary, by putting on 3 crews at making bricks. God sent in folks to help. I was amazed. French administrators from as far as 500 miles away stopped by to see what I was doing, see what they could do to help. One undertook to supply the beams for all the rafters. Others loaned me their trucks, their chauffeurs. God undertook. We have the hospital and the doctors and all as I've told you. Very few realize the beginning days of the hospital now. But it means an awful lot to me. Because when I think back, how good God was to provide all that. And all I can say is that God's altogether faithful. God's callings are God's enablings. So whatever he's called you to do, trust him to give you the ability to do. And do it as unto him, and he'll see you through every time.